As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Hello, I'm Mark Chapman. Welcome to the Business of Sport podcast on The Athletic. Matt Slater with us as usual. And our guest today is Rick Parry, chair of the English Football League, which is made up of 72 clubs in three professional leagues beneath the Premier League. Hugely experienced in football, he also served as chief exec of the Premier League and has held the same role at Liverpool. Rick, welcome to the Business of Sport podcast. Thank you very much for talking to us. Just first of all, explain your remit as chair of the EFL.
Well, I guess the clue is in the title. It's fairly wide-ranging. In theory, it's part-time, 2 days a week. Well, that's what I'm paid for anyway. It's worked out at 7 days a week through the pandemic. But I actually think it's about saving the pyramid. You know, that's what makes the job worthwhile. We have a fantastic network of clubs. And the EFL matters, and we've got great opportunities ahead of us for meaningful change. So I guess it's looking at the big stuff, not getting dragged into the weeds whenever possible.
When we talk about saving the pyramid, protecting the pyramid, how much of that involves dealing with the 72? How much does that involve, would you say, dealing with other leagues and bodies that aren't within your remit?
It's a mix because, you know, clearly you have to have confidence of the 72. That's really important. We have a great mix of clubs. They're diverse. We have big clubs who aspire to be in the Premier League. We have very, very small clubs. We have fan-owned clubs. We have billionaire owners. It's a fantastic mix and they're all important. You know, the key is it's all about 72, making sure we don't have divisions. We have a great collective spirit, I would say, that was seen right through the pandemic. You know, in years gone by, there have been tensions between the Championship and lower down. We don't have that at the moment. So I think being accessible, being available, talking to the clubs is incredibly important. But then equally engaging outside, if we're going to try and bring about change, is equally important.
You would say at the moment then that the relationship between the Championship and Leagues 1 and 2 is as good as it's been in your tenure, would you say?
Well, I haven't been there very long, so it's only 2 years. Seems like 20, but it's only 2 years. What I would say is it's been good throughout my tenure. When I took the job, I wanted to make sure that, you know, we had a fighting chance. We weren't going to be facing rifts. And I think right from the off, the mood was good. Directors were all working together, there was a good collective spirit. So it's definitely been strong throughout my tenure, but I think it became even stronger during the challenges of the pandemic. We really saw people pulling together, supporting each other, and it was, to be honest, very rewarding.
How are relations with the Premier League, Rick?
Well, look, you know, I'm a great admirer of the Premier League. It'd be crazy to say otherwise. I think we have a divergence of view at the moment, it would be fair to say, on the outcome of Tracy's review and the way forward. So it'd be silly to say that we agree on everything. We're quite a long way apart on some things, but listen, relations are cordial, professional. We talk regularly. You know, we debate regularly. I think we respect each other's positions and views. So
let's get into that. We spoke to Tracy Crouch last week. She discussed in detail her fan-led review. It's continuing to dominate the back pages, or certainly kind of the debate within the industry. Those disagreements then. She described to us your relatively late conversion to agreeing that there's a need for an independent football regulator as you realizing that it was sort of the train was leaving the station, and at the very least you needed to be at the station. Is that a fair assessment of your view on an independent football regulator?
I think it probably is. I think we've got a lot of respect for Tracy. I think the report is really thorough. I hate football cliches, but there isn't a better one, and we have been in a sense describing this as a game of two halves, because before Tracy's interim report, we tried to argue robustly that we were capable of governing ourselves. And I genuinely believe that. We have taken great strides in terms of fit and proper persons test, implementing PNS regulations, implementing salary caps, albeit short-lived. There is a mood amongst clubs to have better regulation. We don't have an issue with that. But I think particularly when Tracy's interim report came out, you know, we'd lost that argument. She was not going to be convinced, at which point, you know, you either engage or you stick your fingers in your ears. And for us, there's no point in sticking your fingers in your ears. So I think Tracy would probably say we haven't agreed on every detail, but we have enormous respect for what she's done. We invited her to join our board strategy day last week, which was really valuable. That was an excellent session. Board members were able to sort of question her, be skeptical, listen to her responses. They were really impressed. They felt it was really valuable. And then on club calls this week, it was interesting, particularly League One and League Two, a lot of support for the whole principle and moving forwards and backing the report. So we respect the differences, I think, are behind us. We've argued our case. And if you look at regulation in terms of what Tracy has recommended, licensing systems, license conditions, real-time monitoring, solvency, cash break even, better governance, no issue. Absolutely no issue with that at all. Who could argue against it? So, you know, we're with her on that. I think our issue will become defining the boundaries of what we continue to administer and what the regulator does. So as I said, our view is constructive discussion, be at the table, look at the detail and hopefully come up with a solution that's better for the whole of the game. But to be at the table, or in Tracy's words, to be on the train, why wouldn't you?
Going back to something near the start of that answer where you talked about we thought we could govern ourselves, what are the barriers to you being able to govern yourself? And what will an independent regulator be able to do to overcome those barriers?
I think that, as I said, I genuinely felt that within the EFL, we were making progress. The clubs have a willingness to change the regulations. League One and League Two level, they work pretty well. We have a limit of turnover that can be spent on wages. That's been in place for a long time. We've changed some of the fundamental weaknesses that led to Bury. So, for example, new owners have to put in cash and they have to prove their cash up front, which seems fairly obvious, but it actually wasn't the case before. And we've been pretty robust with a number of clubs, without going into detail, in terms of owners and directors over the last 12, 18 months. So that's been working. In terms of the Championship, one of the barriers is that we're forced to adopt the Premier League's profit and sustainability regulations. And by any measure, our clubs are neither profitable nor sustainable. They just can't be in the Championship. You know, 107% of turnover spent on wages, 300 million plus of losses, 1.3 billion of debt. It clearly isn't working. That's been a source of tension. I think another source of tension is the fact that we have one set of disciplinary processes, the Premier League has another. So when promoted clubs leave us with large losses, we have no say on what happens. Literally, in my first day in the job, I did have a conversation with Greg Clark and Richard Masters. I'd come fresh from UEFA, the CFCB, which oversees financial fair play, and said, surely what we need is an independent body that oversees all of the financial regulation. What could be simpler? But there was no enthusiasm for that. It hasn't happened. So I think what a regulator can bring that we can't within the EFL bring is that total solution across the game.
I think we're getting to the thorny bit, right, Rick? Money. So in the official EFL response, you know, you did all the sort of polite stuff, you know, they, you know, thank you for your work, and you know, we, some things we agree, some things we don't, but it's all good. But you talked about, and you've been consistent on this really since you've come into the job, that football, particularly at your end of it, needs a fundamental reset in terms of its finances. It needs additional distributions alongside, and I think this is important because this is often the charge that comes from the Premier League, why would we give good money to bad businesses? You're very key in the same sentence, alongside appropriate cost controls. So let's do this in two bits. What's the additional distribution you need? How much more does the EFL need from the Premier League?
If we can just change the terminology a little bit, Matt, because I don't think it's about what the EFL needs or wants from the Premier League. It's not about handouts. It's not about begging bowls or the other pejorative terms that we've had to listen to. This is about, do we believe in the pyramid? And it's not 92, because one of the heartening things, most heartening things at our board discussion last week was, and it wasn't in response to anything Tracy had said to us, but it was spontaneous. And we did say, by the way, we do have to look downwards as well as upwards. You know, we have to be consistent and recognise our responsibilities given the flow of clubs from the National League upwards and downwards. So it's about those 110, 120 clubs in the pyramid. It is not about us against the Premier League. So the whole premise is, this is about looking at what works for every club. It's what works in the longer term for those in danger of relegation from the Premier League, just as much as it is for those aspiring to get up from the Championship, and just as much as it is for making the clubs in League One and League Two properly sustainable and not reliant on owner funding. So our position on it is really simply stated. And as you said, I've been saying it for 18 months, so we haven't changed. So it is, combine the media rights of the Premier League and the EFL, because selling against each other, clashing kickoff times, there is potential to generate more revenue by working together. So that's step one. Step two, and I imagine we might talk about them later, but abolish parachute payments, add them back into the pot, then split 75-25 between the Premier League and the EFL. And it is an and, because it doesn't happen automatically, and this is important for us, halve the gap between the bottom of the Premier League and the top of the Championship. Because if you look at 2018-19, for example, Huddersfield, bottom of the Premier League, received £97 million. Norwich, top of the Championship, received 8.5. That is too big a gap. If we halve that gap, then we make the transition upwards and downwards much more palatable. And it really is about just taking that helicopter view of saying, is this a better solution for every club? Because, you know, it cannot possibly be right that, you know, it's a catastrophe to be relegated and an enormous challenge to be promoted.
Just on that before, because I'm sure Mark wants to jump in with some specific things in your answer. Just to establish, just so our listeners understand, and we probably should remind everyone that you were the first Premier League chief exec and you then went on to run Liverpool. So you've seen the other side. You've seen the whole picture, right? And as you've mentioned already, you've worked at UEFA and you've seen their financial fair play rules. So you've seen how the other half live. Back in 1992, the split was between the top flight and the other three divisions was 50-50, right?
No, it was 75-25.
Oh, was it? Okay, so that's often misreported, isn't it? It was 50-25, 12.5, 12.5. What was it exactly?
It was 75 to the first division and then 25 to the amongst the second, third and fourth divisions. One of the things that was challenging in the 1980s was that the formula changed three times in 5 years. So there was no stability, which in part led to the Premier League because, you know, back when live football started, which was only in 1983, you know, it wasn't in the 1800s. It's not that long ago.
Live, as in live TV.
Live TV, coverage. Yeah, coverage of football. Yeah. you know, first deal, it was shared equally. The second deal in 1985, believe it or not, you know, there was a row, threats of breakaways. So it went to 50-50. Then in 1988, when the rows were even more intense and more threats of breakaways and pretty much carnage, and ironically, and it really is ironic in the context of, you know, what's happening today, Football League introduced the three-year rule to stop clubs from leaving. That's when it changed then to 75-25. So there was never any stability. It kept changing.
Fine. If we let the Premier League count parachute payments in their overall solidarity package, the current situation, would we agree? I mean, I know there's some disagreement because the Premier League like to include other payments they make, which are legitimate and really good payments. Is it about 84-16?
Probably. As you said, it depends on the definitions. You cannot... Listen, you can try and justify parachute payments. I will mount the counter-argument. What you cannot do in any scenario is to describe them as solidarity. That is just ridiculous. Government ministers have been fooled into doing it repeatedly. It is no part of solidarity. So let's just be very clear on our position on that. If they're redistributed as part of the pot, then they're really valuable, but they're not part of solidarity at the moment. Now, if the Premier League says, well, clearly we can afford to part with them, great, that can be part of the mix, but they are not solidarity. Parachute payments are the problem, they're not the solution.
Who defends parachute payments, and what is their argument for defending them?
I think those in receipt of them are quite defensive about them. And the rationale is clearly that you need support when you fall out of the Premier League. But again, if we keep it simple, the clue is in the name. Nobody ever needed a parachute to fall off a step. The parachutes are there because there's a cliff between the two and it's unbridgeable. Now, I don't know whether this is the moment, but, you know, again, if the logic is that you need to have a smooth transition downwards because you've got wages at a Premier League level, there is logic in that. And nobody is saying we want to kill the big clubs. We want clubs thriving, succeeding, coming back into the Championship, being successful. We're totally and utterly in favour of that. But if we just look at one stat, between 2010-11 and 2018-19, Premier League wages doubled. So what might you imagine would happen to parachute payments over that period if they're genuinely to compensate? You would think they'd have doubled. According to Premier League figures, they went from 30 million to 265 million. They went up ninefold. And the position now... And I talk a lot about gaps rather than absolute figures because gaps are really important. But the position currently is that a parachute club in its first year gets around 44 million. It's actually baked into the solidarity agreement that all the other clubs in the Championship get 11% of a year one parachute. So you're automatically saying they're going to get very, very substantially less. So they're getting around 4 million. So you've got a gap between those in receipt of year one parachute and everybody else of 40 million. So if that isn't a competitive advantage, and bearing in mind the average turnover of all the clubs who are not getting parachute payments in the Championship is 23 million, how on earth are they supposed to compete? Other than behaving irrationally and relying on that's back to the owner funding, that's back to wages at 107% of turnover.
Yeah,
I think anybody rational looking at that from above would just think this is completely barking mad. I wasn't necessarily going to raise the Tesco analogy, but I might now and say, well, you know, in what industry does Tesco give huge payments to a selected few of its competitors? And you know, look at the Championship table at the moment, look at the top three, you know, look at last season, we could have had three parachute clubs promoted. It's getting harder and harder to bridge that gap. And as I said, the way that they have risen in recent years, it's almost under the radar, but that really is the challenge. It becomes harder and harder for the others to compete. So, you know, rationally, let's just say, as I said, and we're not looking purely at the EFL, this isn't about a begging bowl, because, I mean, the other myth is that, you know, that's always been propounded is the success of the Premier League is based on competitive balance and the fact that anybody can beat anybody on a given day. That's not true. There's a lot of research which actually kills that.
No.
What you need is competition at the top.
Yeah.
Vibrant competition at the top, which they've got. And the reality, whether anybody likes it or not, in truth is you get big audiences when the big teams are winning. That is a fact. And I don't think anybody says that the big teams don't drive the revenue for the Premier League, although I suppose those arguing the Tesco analogy might have a little bit of a challenge with their inconsistency. But you also need vibrant relegation battles. So you actually need a variety of clubs, a mix of clubs coming up, challenging, being competitive to maintain the value of the Premier League. And as I said, your starting point has to be, do we value the pyramid and the Premier League's place? We don't subscribe to this. It's our money. Why do you want gifts? It's fun. You know, we have a fundamentally different starting point.
You talked about the broadcast deal and the game as a whole should have one broadcast deal and then the money shared out from there. Would that also include the National League, who have a broadcast deal? Forget the Premier League. If the National League came to the EFL and went, can we bring our broadcast deal in with you? And you then subsequently virtually have a fourth division. I mean, it's not far off a fourth division as it is it, Rick, really? But does that principle, you're looking up at the Premier League to amalgamate the broadcast deal. If the National League came to you and said, can we do that? Would you agree?
The very clear message from our board last week is we have to look downwards. And that encompasses revenue generation. It also encompasses financial regulation and cost control. It would encompass youth development. If the logic is, and by the way, when you say one TV deal, it may be semantic, but it's not necessarily one TV deal. I think it's the way we sell collectively, yeah. Because, you know, we have a very exciting championship. We have really exciting playoffs. So I don't think it's a case of just putting it all into one pot, but I think it's working collectively and then thinking, well, we can actually segment this in different ways. You know, we can use the EFL maybe as a, you know, a test bed for OTT. And if you look at what we've done with iFollow in recent years, you know, that there are all sorts of ways where it just says it makes more sense. We think if we're working together, we think we'll maximize the revenue that way.
We talk about the competitive balance of the Premier League and to a certain extent, the top of the Championship, as you've mentioned. And we started this whole discussion about whether there have been divisions between Championship and League One and League Two. Are there still, within the EFL, certain rules that Leagues One and Two have to abide by that Championship don't? Because you could argue that League One suffers similar competitive balance issues to the Championship. The top two in League One, Rick, are Rotherham and Wickham, both relegated last season. The third side relegated last season, Sheffield Wednesday, are just outside the playoff spots. Rotherham are the West Brom equivalent between League One and Championship.
Yes, absolutely. Can't disagree with that. And the problem is that whenever you're looking at percentages, as the amounts of money rise, the differences actually get greater in absolute terms. There is no magic wand to solve that. We are never saying we want parity between the Championship and the Premier League. That's totally unrealistic. We will never have parity between the Championship and League One and League Two. But maybe one of the things we have to look at is, and we haven't discussed this with the clubs yet, so I don't want to set hairs running, but, you know, maybe we have to look at some form of merit payments in each of our divisions so that, you know, instead of just having a flat line, there is a sliding scale. Where you try and address the cliff edge division by division, because the principles are the same, it's just the amounts are smaller.
I mean, that's really interesting, because we had the guys from Fair Game on a few weeks ago, and they've got this sustainability index idea, which I think is a little bit different, but it does have within it an idea that you reward good behaviour. You know, you incentivise clubs to behave well. And it's interesting, isn't it, I think, that Rotherham, they are that yo-yo team between League One and the Championship. And one of the reasons they keep going down from the Championship is they run a sustainable business.
Yeah.
I mean, they are almost the club that sort of prove every point. They're well run. They're really well run, so they go up from League One, but they're too well run for the Championship.
Yes, And again, I think in part that comes back to the mad model in the championship, where back to 2018-19, 380 million of owner funding required, 16 million a club, and as I've said on previous occasions, you know, the most expensive lottery ticket on the planet. And I think our purpose is all about making clubs sustainable throughout the pyramid at every level. You can't prevent investment, and who would want to prevent investment when it brings about improvement? But you shouldn't have a dependency on owner funding. We shouldn't be dependent on the handout culture. And making clubs sustainable, we say, as you touched on, Matt, is two things. It's about regulation and redistribution hand in hand. And that really is the change of tack we took with Tracy. Because if you're going to introduce solvency tests, you could just regulate 80% of our clubs out of existence. Redistribution makes them solvent. Regulation makes them sustainable in the long term.
And these appropriate cost controls, I mean, obviously you did try with League One and League Two, and certainly a huge majority of League Two clubs were up for it, a significant majority in League One. You never actually tried it on with the Championship. You never actually went as far as a vote. The PFA obviously didn't like it, and you had to unwind the rules. Where are we at now with cost controls in the Championship?
Well, the other reason we couldn't do it in the Championship was the Premier League objected, and we're bound by their FFP rules. Because they thought it would be an unfair constraint if the clubs coming down with all that parachute money couldn't spend it.
Hang on, Rick. The Premier League can object to what you're trying to do in the EFL, but you can't have a say in what their rules are in the Premier League that might affect clubs coming into the EFL.
Yeah.
How the hell does that work?
Because it's part of the solidarity agreement that the EFL signed up to. A condition of getting the solidarity payments from the Premier League is we have to adopt their rules in the Championship.
Wow. He who pays the piper.
I think we're getting bolder now.
A, why do you think you're getting bolder? And if you are getting bolder, what is causing you to get bolder?
I think two things. One is, I think what's happened in the past is ridiculous. It just doesn't make sense. And, you know, given the financial challenges, unless we do bring about some change, then I fear for the pyramid. I talked to the select committee about it 18 months ago. We tried it through Project Big Picture. We've tried it through the Premier League strategic review, wherever that's up to. Our best hope, and our only hope probably, is Tracy. And bringing about some independence that can look and say, hang on, this is just, you know, we do need some consistency from top to bottom. This actually doesn't make any sense at all.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time, the Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
probably be bored of parachute payments, but they're my bugbear as well. I mean, they are literally half the amount of money that the Premier League hands down the pyramid. So it's very, 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 very important.
Matt, can you just stop using that phrase about what the Premier League hands down?
Oh, sorry, sorry. I've been talking to them too much.
It's what they hand to their clubs.
Yes. No, you're absolutely
right. It's nothing to do with handing it down the pyramid.
You're absolutely right. I'm sorry. I've been brainwashed. I've got to stop doing it. That money is significant. It's huge. Right now, I saw a newspaper report the other day referring to secret talks between you and the Premier League, which I wasn't aware there were secret since we've talked about, I think, pretty openly. Where are you at? My understanding is there are a few ideas on the table. I think the Premier League realises that parachute payments have had their day, and at the very least they need to change their name. It's become a bit toxic. I think they do have some interesting ideas. I mean, one or two have been explained to me. One in particular was really complicated. Where are we going with parachute payments? Are they just going to be scrapped and thrown in the pot like you want it to be, or are we going to come up with a different formula?
I don't know, because as I said, we want clubs thriving at every level. You know, we don't want to kill clubs that are relegated, far from it. We absolutely get that there needs to be better transitional arrangements. We don't think parachute payments are the solution, and nor do we think, and this is really important, nor do we think that merely tackling parachute payments, because at the end of the day, all that means for the Premier League is it's a reclassification. It could be a really helpful one, but it doesn't bring any more money down. We think the focus needs to be on that total package, not just on parachute payments and distributing them in a different way. It's about more money. Parachute payments would be one element. But we don't really just want to get, in time-honoured fashion, picked off with bits and pieces here and there. We want a proper solution.
You are planning an independent financial unit now, aren't you? And an ad has gone out to lead that unit. Is that in some way, Rick, a recognition that you've been a bit behind on the financial governance of clubs, and that could have been something that could have been in place at some point over the last decade? I realise the majority of that has not been under your chair.
Well, as I said, I raised it literally on day one in terms of coming with my UEFA experience of saying, you know, this might be a better way. It does take time. We have been through which rather kind of took our attention. We've also, of course, spent a huge amount of time and resource on PNS cases. We've had Derby, we've had Sheffield Wednesday, we've had Reading, which was actually a little more straightforward. But, you know, again, in part, it was the ludicrous amount of time, elapsed time, and management time and cost in trying to charge clubs, given that some of the rules were also inadequate. And, you know, again, listen, I'm not here to knock the Premier League, because I said I am the Premier League's biggest fan in many ways. But, you know, one of our challenges was the rules they imposed were the ability to sell stadia. That was not the case in the old EFL rules. So our original rules were better in that respect. So we had that challenge with Derby and with Sheffield Wednesday.
So these stadia sales have been because the Premier League have allowed them?
Yeah. They came in with the Premier League rules that we adopted. The previous EFL rules did not allow stadium sales. But anyway, listen, that's history. When we sort of sat back and looked at the process that we had to go through, it just wasn't working. You can't spend 2 years on these cases. You know, what you need to move towards is real-time monitoring, real-time analysis. You really don't want to be deducting points retrospectively and affecting the impact of the integrity of the championship. You need real-time monitoring to know what's happening now so that you can actually cut off the problems as and when they happen. And so we've been working on the independent unit for quite some time, just in terms of it looks like it has two things. It does have independence, so there will never be any suggestions that the board is somehow biased or interfering. And by the way, there haven't been those suggestions, and it definitely hasn't been the case, but you can always improve. So making it properly independent, giving it dedicated resource, just makes enormous sense. That's not in response to anything that Tracy has done. We were working on it anyway, and we have to continue to work on it because we have clubs to monitor. So
is it already up and running then?
No, we're just finalising. The clubs in principle have agreed. We've got to finalise the rules, the regulations. We've got to put people in place. We're trying to do that. We're motoring on with that now to get it in place for the sort of next round of monitoring. And then really the debate with DCMS is going to be, how does that dovetail with the regulator? This is not part of us coming up with some desperate plea to say we don't need a regulator. We're doing it because we have to do it in the next year or two just to manage our processes more efficiently. And frankly, compared with the amount of money we've been spending on external lawyers, it will be much more cost efficient. We'll actually save a lot of money.
If I'm a Derby fan listening to this and I think the EFL have allowed my club to be nigh on ruined and I fear for its future, what would you say?
EFL have allowed it.
You know, Rick, that a club, Bury fans said the same thing when Bury went, that as the governing body of the EFL, when a club is in trouble or when a club goes to the wall, your organisation will be blamed. That is one of the things that fans direct their love for their club, their love for their community that is being ruined. They want to know how it can happen.
It's because of the owner funding model and the necessity in the Championship for owners to put in excessive sums. Owner funding is brilliant until it isn't. And, you know, historically, you look at Blackburn, you look at Bolton, Wigan was a bit of an oddity, but the same principle. If you have a system that's dependent upon owner funding and owners decide to stop putting in the funding, then you have a major problem. That's what's got to change. It's not the EFL's fault that Mel overcommitted and then decided not to. So admittedly, if we'd had tighter cost controls and we'd had sort of more rigid requirements for limits on owner funding, maybe. But it's back to the fundamentals of how does Mel compete with clubs in receipt of parachute payments? That's what's happening. That is what's wrong with the model. The model has to change.
It's not a good situation, though, is it, Rick, that Derby are in real trouble? I think everyone's realising that now. And one of the issues, they have several, is that they're facing lawsuits from two other EFL clubs, Wickham and Middlesbrough. I mean, that's not something that can sit well with you. You know, we talked an awful lot about the 72, but you have three of your clubs in a dispute that could leave one of them out of business.
Of course, that's undesirable. But I think Middlesbrough's point, and it goes back a long way, and I'm obviously not going into the detail, Middlesbrough's complaint was that the EFL had not been rigorous in enforcing its own rules. And this goes back to 2018 in terms of the stadium sale, in terms of the amortisation. You know what? They were right. They were right. We hadn't.
Well, shouldn't they sue you then?
Well, I think they did originally. But the point they were making was to force us to actually get off the pot and enforce our rules, which is what we did. So I think Middlesbrough do understand that we did our bit. We have enforced the rules rigorously, finally, albeit probably a long time after the event. What we can't have is repeats of that. We've got to be more on our toes, more rigorous. And the independent unit will help with that. But certainly, I don't think anybody can say, and the mood in the Championship, as I said, is mood within all the divisions is really good. It's really good within the Championship. And I think people do recognise that people who step out of line have actually been punished. And there's quite a powerful disincentive not to. But then it's back to how on earth, within the constraints of the current rules and those extraordinary parachute payments, which are boosting clubs' turnover, how do you compete?
But if you can't compete, then you have to recognise that you can't, surely. I mean, and that, I suppose, is where the anger will come.
Do we then literally just say, well, let's just have three clubs bouncing up and down all the time?
No, absolutely not. But you talk about overspending to try and keep up with clubs who've got parachute payments. And if that is then putting a club at threat, then you have to recognise your place within the pyramid. I agree with you completely on parachute payments, but I don't want my local club and the community that relies on that club to go bust because I'm chasing a dream that is impossible within my means.
Well, I couldn't agree more, which is why we need the fundamental rethink, and it's why we need that dual combination of better distribution and better regulation. The two go hand in hand. If we simply have better distribution, more money coming down, it will all get spent, and we'll all be in the same situation, except we'll have a bigger problem because the amounts at stake will be greater. So it's absolutely the two going hand in hand. They're inseparable. We have to address, and bearing in mind the fundamental principle, the fundamental purpose, as I said, is making clubs sustainable, then it's absolutely about the two going hand in hand. It's really, really simple. Getting there isn't simple. Getting there is incredibly difficult. But in terms of identifying the problem and what we need, that's pretty straightforward, we would say.
Given everybody is together, as you say, is it difficult to keep everybody together? Because I'm going to pick random clubs here. Is it difficult because what Leighton Orient might necessarily want or need in League Two is completely different to, say, what Bournemouth need in the Championship in trying to get back in the Premier League? So some of your bigger Championship clubs might push back on certain regulations that are going to benefit Leighton Orient because it might prevent them winning the lottery.
Yeah, that's not the position they're taking at the moment, I'm delighted to say. I think we do recognise the value of the pyramid. Nobody has said, and you listen, in years gone by, it used to crop up regularly, Premier League Two, you know, cast Leagues One and Leagues Two adrift. There's been no talk of that. I have not heard a single Championship club do anything other than acknowledge the responsibilities, because again, it's promotion and relegation that links the entire pyramid. It's not just between the Championship and the Premier League, as you've rightly said. You know, you look at Rotherham, we've got the challenges between League One and the Championship, and between League Two and the Championship, and the League One and League Two, and between League Two and the National League. So this is all about the pyramid from top to bottom. And of course it's challenging. And of course the needs of the biggest in the Championship are different from those at the bottom of League Two. They are different, but you know, that's the challenge. That's the variety. That is frankly, that's the beauty of the EFL.
Do you look at other leagues in any other country and think, yeah, that's the way to do it? Do you look at other sports and how they are run either here or abroad and think, oh, well, maybe if we could take that from that sport and implement that, that might work?
I think we're always open-minded. You can never, ever be complacent. You can never look backwards. You can never say, well, it's always been done this way. I love learning. I've travelled a lot in between my time at Liverpool and coming to the EFL. So, I've been the Middle East, the Far East, North America, seen lots of different models. What nobody has is the depth of the pyramid that we have here, clearly. That is unique, which gives unique challenges. It gives us something very unique to be proud of. Nobody has that number of full-time clubs. So we have slightly different problems. I think, you know, if you look at France, you look at Germany, you look at Holland, you look at Spain now, they're ahead of us in terms of financial regulation, and I think have been for quite a long time. Definitely there are lessons we can learn there. And I said, in terms of our financial unit and its principles, that came from UEFA. If people have got better ideas or great experience, we're happy to learn from it. We're not inventing wheels for the sake of it.
And therefore, do you think you need more diversity?
Yes, absolutely. And yes, we do. No question about that throughout the game.
In exec roles?
Yes. Well, in all roles, in exec roles, in coaching roles, we do. Simple as that, we do. And we have to do better.
Just going back to that Derby point, I thought it was interesting that the very first club to shoot down Tracy Crouch's review was Aston Villa. And of course, there was a sliding door moment between Derby and Aston Villa, the playoff final. How do you feel about that? Are you annoyed at the hypocrisy?
There's no point in getting emotionally tangled in, you know, individual clubs, because this is about recognizing we need to change the system. You know, Tracy, it was interesting that in her written report, as well as subsequently, she did highlight that slight paradox that, you know, it But for one goal, but for a slip on the pitch, it could have been very different. It could have been Derby up and Aston Villa down. But what you can't have in a system that's working and making all the clubs sustainable is that reliance on, you know, that slice of luck. And there could have been such a massive difference in the story of the two clubs. That isn't sustainable. That just doesn't make sense.
Christian Perslow did say, comments after Tracy Crouch's report, we need to be careful of killing the golden goose.
Well, yes, but, you know, what does that mean? Does it mean the Premier League is opposed to better regulation, better transparency? Because I'm actually a great believer in good governance being a benefit. I don't see it as a hindrance. So I'm not sure how that kills a golden goose. Is he saying the Premier League can't afford to distribute more money down the pyramid? Because that, frankly, is ridiculous. And I sort of don't want to blind everybody with stats, but, you know, this is a really interesting one. If you go back to 2008-09, which I would say was a vintage period for English clubs in Europe, we'd won the Champions League twice in the previous 5 years. We'd been finalists four times. Three times we'd had three teams out of four in the semi-finals. We were top of the UEFA coefficients. It doesn't get much better in terms of our ability to compete. And if you look at Premier League wages then, compared with where they are now, and in particular, it's back to my analysis of gaps, but La Liga was the second ranked club in Europe. The Premier League wage bill was £394 million more than La Liga's. Premier League was paying 1.75 times more in wages than La Liga, and the other club, the other leagues, of course, were some way below. If you fast forward to 2018-19, La Liga is number one ranked in Europe. We're number two, so we've actually fallen off the perch. Guess what the gap was in wages paid between the Premier League and La Liga in 2018-19? So it was 394 million in 2008-09 when we were absolutely top of the pile.
I'll say it's trebled, the gap.
Matt?
I know it's a lot. I was going to say trebled. Mark got there first. I'm going to go, I'll go more than trebled.
The gap had widened to 1.3 billion.
All right, so
wow.
There you go.
Right. Yeah.
So the gap has increased by a billion. So it's pretty much is trebled.
Yeah.
Now, ironically, if you said that the Premier League was competitive, massively competitive, top of the pile in 2008-09. And in order to get there, it was paying 1.75 times the ratio of the next highest paying league. If you use that ratio of 1.75 in 2018-19, then there would be 450 million to spare to share with the pyramid. So to say, and you know, the truth is, they're just in their own arms race, competing to stay in. Well, if you're not bothered about being relegated, because it isn't so catastrophic, then you don't have an arms race to stay up. So we would say, in reality, with less money to distribute, certainly the 14 non-top six, and I don't say big six, non-top six clubs, they'd have the same players. They'd just pay them a bit less.
Couple of final things before we go. Do you know who we haven't mentioned once? We've been talking for nearly an hour. You know who we haven't mentioned once? What body we haven't mentioned?
Oh, dear.
Yes, well, I know. Yes.
We haven't mentioned the FA a single time.
Are we speaking to a board member, Mark?
In this whole chat.
Yeah.
What does that tell us all?
Well, I think it... I think it tells us, you know, sadly, all we need to know. And again, I would say it's an organisation that's been dominated, hasn't stood up to the Premier League for the last 20 years, and which is a great shame. But, you know, again, this is, and I am an FA board member, I recognise my responsibilities, and we do want to improve the FA without question. But it's a similar debate that's sort of raging in Europe with UEFA. Can you govern and be competing in the same commercial pot? And, you know, where does the FA derive its revenues? It's largely from the FA Cup. who do they need to participate in the FA Cup? Premier League teams. So, you know, how independent in reality at the moment is the FA?
When should you come back on to tell us that things have improved and got better?
2030.
On our World Cup show. Yeah.
Right. No, I mean, listen, we, as I've said, we do think this is the biggest opportunity we've had. And it does take independence because patently we cannot reach a solution. We haven't reached a solution within the game. And Tracy has done us, I think, a great service. It's a wake-up call. As I said, we like a lot of what's in the report. Bits we still don't like, but as I said, we respect her. She's been thorough. It's a really, really decent piece of work. She cares passionately. She gets it. So we have respect for her. And this cannot be kicked into the long grass, and, you know, government can't be bullied into doing nothing.
Well, I hope, for the sake of the game, that it's not 9 years before you come on again. Thank you for being with us. Thank you, Rick.
Thanks, Rick.
Thanks very much.
All right, that's it. Thanks to Rick for joining us. You can subscribe to The Athletic right now and get a 33% discount. Just go to theathletic.com/footballpod. And I'm back on Monday for The Athletic Football Podcast. Thanks for listening.
The Athletic.